And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hey, everybody. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. I am Phil Lairness, or what's available of him, at 6 a.m. Pacific time.
Look at you.
And over there in Motown, Detroit, Michigan, it's the Motor City Madman who gets more done by 9:15 Pacific time than most people get done by 9:20, probably.
Eastern Standard Time.
It's Dean Haglund. It's Dean Haglund. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, that's true. You're Eastern Standard. Now, that's surprising to me, because I always have thought of Detroit as being a Midwestern city, not an Eastern city. And I'm wrong.
I agree.
You agree. Okay.
Yeah. Because it seems weird that you just fly for 50 minutes to get to Chicago and it's an hour later. That doesn't, I guess that's a thing. But
I don't know. I don't even know if this is interesting. I don't know at 6:15 in the morning what is interesting, what isn't interesting. But I would be curious, and I never have been before, but I would be curious to, I don't know, research where the where and why the time zones were created where they were.
I'm going to blame Lewis and Clark, but that's just me. I got to think it's historical like that. Maybe Benjamin Franklin. He seemed to set up a lot of oddities.
Well, wait a second. Benjamin Franklin? When did we adopt modern time zones?
I think when the telegraph came in.
Well, so that would be well after Benjamin Franklin, wouldn't it? Because if there was a telegraph, would Paul Revere really have needed to take that ride?
Well, not everybody was wired up then. You know, you had to go. Still door-to-door service.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, I can hear Maurice Terenzio writing us an email about this right now.
Hilarious. Can't wait.
You know, but whatever time zone you're in, there was a critical, seasonal change this past weekend with the launch of the 100th National Football League season.
Wow. Not that you're counting, but 100 seasons of football.
Yeah, 100 of professional football. What could be more
exciting? Can you see them all?
What did you, how did you, what kind of gear did you break out? what were the snacks? How many people came over for the big, did the Lions play this weekend? Was there a big,
You know, how many times have we talked about, I have removed sports from my things to do and things to think about and watch. I just did it because there's too much to think about and too much to do and too much to watch.
So indeed, you did, though, when you were in L.A., you were following hockey. So does that mean that
hockey? We would go to a hockey game now and then as a fun thing to do, but not follow hockey per se.
But I mean, were you aware of where, like, the Kings were in the rankings in the standings? Boy, that was in the, like, where do they rank? I knew where the Kings ranked in terms of their gate, in terms of their box office.
No, I never followed the standings or the things. And then there's only, you know, minor interest when it came to playoffs. And then, you know, hey, somebody wins. Hooray. So
I know that this is me. I have a fondness for this game. You do not. But if I had lived in Australia, I would have actually become an avid follower of the Australian Basketball League. I seriously would have. I like the way the game is played. And if you don't think I've watched YouTube videos of recent Australian basketball games, you would be incorrect, sir.
Wait, right. is it Aussie rules basketball? Like, are they
I feel like it's basketball the way that it should be played, actually. It's really good. Who cares? The point here it is, the national pastime, the NFL, love it or leave it, make America great again, and here we are, we're talking about Aussie football.
I didn't go to one sporting event at all in Australia. I should have gone to a footy game, some sort of footy game, as they call it.
There are people right now raising money or taking money from government programs in order to build a wall around this podcast. The point was, Dean, that it was the 100th. I thought about this again. So I virtually know the names of no football players, certainly no stars, other than, like, you know, Tom Brady, who's been around since I was a kid, for crying out loud. But I really don't. And, you know, I did what, I guess you're supposed to do. I turned on 5 minutes of the Rams game because the Rams are a local team and it was opening day, and boredom bleeding through my pores. And honestly, it was just terrible, terrible football that I was watching. But regardless, it just reminded me again, and I think we've talked about this before, but just how disturbing it is to me, on a level that I have never really heard anyone else other than me articulate, that football and NASCAR are the two most popular spectator sports in America.
Really?
And they bother me because of the fact, you know, never mind the violent. I actually understand the promise of violence being the appeal. What I don't understand is these are the two sports where you literally can't see the people participating. You can't see a human face. They're
right.
You know,
they're covered.
One, they're inside cars. The other is they're covered even more now with helmets than ever before. So it begs the question, why aren't they games played by robots?
I want the game to be played by robots. Well, that would be awesome.
Given how dangerous they're truly like, what is it, like arena games? What did they call them? You know, in Rome. But that's what they're so dangerous, right? These players don't live long, for crying out loud, and the not only the damage they do to their bodies, but also the risk at which they are for brain disease, for concussions, for brain disease, for mental health problems, striking them at staggeringly young ages. And one has to conclude that literally part of the appeal for the sport is knowing that humans are sacrificing their long-term health for this blood sport.
Right. But for the entertainment and to get paid a healthy sum. So there's money involved. Would you bang your head against the wall for $1 million?
Once, maybe. The question is, Dean, would you do it multiple times a day for several years, because that's what they're doing? And when you find out how many of these people end up penniless, in no small part because of probably their inability to lead cognitively functional lives. I don't know. But anyway, but it is shocking to me again, this idea that the human element is not a part of this. I am drawn to sports from time to time and drawn to it for the drama of human capability.
Right.
You know, there are other sports where, especially thanks to television, you can share so many indelible human moments with the participants. And you're utterly denied that. And so what does that say about America that our two most popular sports are utterly devoid of human element? I mean, they're video games then, aren't they? Except you don't get, you know, the thrill, the endorphin rush of first person activity. But
well, okay, but you know, there is ways of connecting. In NASCAR, you can rent a headset and listen to the crew chief talk to his driver about when to pit and all that sort of thing. You can come in on the strategy drivers do. So there's a way there that, you know, you rent the headset and it's fun in the stands. On the football, it was, I believe, a very famous live television director who first got the close-ups of Joe Namath as he was thinking through his final couple plays. And it changed how they filmed and did sports on TV.
Okay, that is long ago gone. I mean, you know, now, after all, they're trying to protect other teams from being able to read the signals that are being called. And so you're denied the Joe Namath-esque. You don't get to be in the pantyhose with Joe Namath. Let's put it that way, right? That was the famous thing about how he revealed that he wore pantyhose while he played. And pantyhose sales skyrocketed, and he became a spokesperson for one of the pantyhose companies, right?
Right.
But anyway, you saying that you can get into the action by listening to the pit crews, I guarantee you that is exactly how most NASCAR fans do not enjoy the pastime. But I do think that it describes almost accurately the way that Stanley Kubrick would have done it. You know, this was a man who, when he moved to England, you know, because he was terrified of flying, even though he was a licensed pilot, by all accounts, used to just stay up at night listening to his radio system that would allow him to listen in on, you know, the FAA chatter. And he would keep track of all the near collisions and near disasters that would take place on a daily.
Well, United Airlines used to let you on Channel 9. You used to be able to listen to the pilots talk to the towers and ground control. I used to really enjoy that. And then apparently I was the only one.
Anyway.
So they discontinued.
I didn't expect us to go this long, but I just wanted to say I was reminded, because we are unique in that regard, this country, that those two sports are so popular and we are denied the emotional human identification factor. And that's unique. Whatever you want to say about it. So why not robots? And I bet you, Dean, in our lifetime, it will be robots that are playing football.
I can't wait.
Because, you know, with all these injuries and ailments and that they are never going to be able to remove from the game, you've just got too many big, strong, fast people projectile launching themselves at other big, strong, fast people. And that's just going to happen. And as was pointed out mathematically decades ago, when the NFL started covering up the findings of CTE, if a relatively small percentage, I forget what the number was, but if a relatively small percentage of mothers in America stop letting their kids play high school football because of the dangers, then the NFL is dead within a certain number of years, because they need to maintain a certain talent pool in order to maintain it. Or, as I've said, you've got illegal aliens playing the game. That's what we let That's where we start to let immigrants and those seeking asylum in. And I'm not, I wish I was joking, but I'll joke later so that we can do it. You know, each week you're kind to ask me about how my eye recovery is going. And
yes.
I actually had stories to share with you of a recovery that is going very, very well.
Oh, good.
And they're born out of the fact that I get to walk everywhere again. I'm not scared walking.
Right.
You know, I mean, I really
tripping on something.
Like you would be shocked at, you know, well, my surgeon was shocked to find out that I had literally cut out walking because I was having too many experiences. Yeah, of either I have to maintain such focus on the ground so that I don't trip over something, but what would happen is that people would pop out of nowhere and surprise me because everything I was looking at was so milky white that it would often be when people were only a handful of feet away before they would just suddenly pop into existence for me. It wasn't like I slowly could see them coming. And then when you couple that with paying attention to your each footstep staring down, you know, you look up,
yeah.
There's no one there. You look down, you look back up a moment later and someone's right on you. And I just started, it was really tense. It was really, really a nerve-wracking experience. So I finally just realized this is not safe for a variety of reasons and cut it out. To say nothing, of course, of hiking, where I really was at risk of misstepping and falling
yeah.
down. And so these things get to be back in my life. And not surprisingly, my blood pressure has been plummeting downwards back towards a healthy range again, just by virtue of reincorporating walking. But the experiences that I've had on coming home from the Breakfast Club, for example, last week, I decided to walk home after our meeting, and I'm walking home, and there is a woman who lives in the neighborhood, has lived in the neighborhood as long as I've lived in the neighborhood, who I went to high school with, and who is on the neighborhood council, and yet the whole time I have lived in this neighborhood, I've never seen her, and it's odd, you know, that I've just never bumped into her. And
right.
You know, we keep in some contact electronically and via social media. And I'm walking home from the Breakfast Club on Wednesday. I'm passing a Starbucks on Hillhurst, one of the new fangled Starbucks that looks like a ski lodge. And way in back, not at the patio in front, not inside the store, but in the patio in back of the Starbucks, from the street, I spot her as I'm walking by. And
what?
At quite a distance. And I think, oh, I want to go over and say hi to her, but I got to get home to get on the midweek drive. And also, you know, I mean, now out of the blue, will that surprise her? So I just immediately send her, you know, a message saying, is it possible that that's you at the Starbucks? I saw you and I thought about coming up and saying hi, but I had to go somewhere. And she said, yeah, I'm here Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. Come in, next time you walk by, come and say hi. Because she drops off her son somewhere, and then she goes there and does work. But what I suddenly realized in that moment was I'd probably gotten it wrong. It's not that I hadn't seen her in all these years. It's that I wasn't seeing much of anything.
In all these years.
Yeah. And, so and look at what is available for me to spot and notice.
Aw, see, there's a whole new world out there.
Yeah. Yeah,
I was
pretending in some ways wasn't there for a long time, right? I was really for years making, you know, doing mental gymnastics to be okay with how my eyesight was diminishing. So so it's quite a different experience. The other thing about walking, again, one of the things is about it being so healthy is it's not just that it's physically healthy. It's not just that you get out your stress because the earth, she can take it, you know.
Right.
So like just a walk to the Breakfast Club and back, that's 4 miles round trip. That's a good walk. And
yeah.
When I was going to see the surgeon this last week for a big checkup, I decided, well, I'm going to walk that. I'm going to do that as a walk. That's a 3.1 mile walk to Glendale Memorial Hospital from Las Feliz. That's a good walk. I'm going to do that. That's less than an hour. And as I'm walking along, I'm getting down into the Glendale section of Las Feliz Boulevard, and you get to the 5 freeway. And anyone in this area knows and will probably know exactly the person I'm thinking of. There is frequently a man who, let's say, works the freeway off-ramp from the 5 onto Las Feliz Boulevard. Just is staked out there at the off-ramp. And, people will give him money. Lily once saw someone give him a full, open up their window and give him a full to-go pizza. I watched this gentleman as I was there on the island with him waiting for the crosswalk, right? As the cars came, and some people gave him money and I looked at him and he looked almost aboriginal, because the skin so dark, in large part because of sun exposure, sun exposure, really hot day. So stripped down to just like a pair of shorts. And sitting there with his bag of change that he's been given, and with a pretty good knife, not a Crocodile Dundee knife, but the kind of knife that you would want there in the outback. And I was reminded of how one time late at night I needed to get some stuff from the Breakfast Club Ranger House and put it into the Breakfast Club at Friendship Auditorium. And Lil texted me saying, no, I'm not going to let you do that, because she was waiting for me, because there's a man, a homeless man, outside cleaning his knife out in front of the door late at night. And I heeded her warning and we left. And I said, he wasn't cleaning his knife because he was lying in wait for me. Like, imagine how useful a really good sharp knife would be if you're living on the street. Yeah. All the uses for it. Yeah. And
lots of uses. Yeah.
And you would from time to time need to clean it. So,
right.
I mean, did my eyes go a little bit wide when I saw the knife? Yeah. But was I scared? No. Of course the guy would have a knife. Right. And I watched him, and I don't know why, but like, he never even addressed me or asked me for anything. And I would see car after car go by, and I found myself digging into my pocket. And at one point, as the crosswalk changed, I said, "Sir, excuse me," and I had to say it again, "Excuse me, sir." And slowly he turned, as if only realizing I was talking to him. And I held out my hand with the money, and I said, "Can I give this to you?" And that's when I noticed that he was starting to cry. And he shook his head no. My money was no good with him. And so I told him to have a good day, and he said, "You have a good day." And I walked away. And so struck by this encounter, the kind of encounter that obviously I haven't been able to have for years. And there was something about, I think, me calling him sir.
And he never gets that kind of
treatment or respect.
So that made a mistake.
Just basic respect. And I don't know. And so empathy was very much the watchword. And I was thinking about it a lot the next day when this man was reported on the local crime apps, as a knife wielding naked man. appearing there at the corner of Riverside and Las Feliz, just a couple blocks away. Indeed, that day, a knife-wielding naked man appeared at the Sizzler. Now, was he truly naked, or did people just fear the worst because he was only wearing a small pair of shorts? I don't know. He shows up from time to time. He lives by the river. And the thing that, look, that's scary. If indeed he was naked and he was, as they say, wielding the knife. Now, holding a knife is a different thing. Right. But obviously your concern is your own safety and the safety of the people you're with first. So, but you read these things online And, you know, you don't go to the places of asking the questions of, okay, was he really wielding it or was he holding it? No, you read it and you go, well, that's shocking. This is a problem. These homeless people, it's a problem. We got to do something about it.
Right.
And,
yeah, yeah.
And sure enough, you read the comments, and the comments are quite, not without reason, I get it, but quite unfeeling. And they lend themselves to always to threat. What are we going to do about it? And there isn't any empathy. But again, as we've talked about before, if you're looking for empathy in any kind of social media platform,
yeah, you're not finding it.
You're barking up the wrong binary code, right?
Right. Because it's binary. It is, oh my gosh, that you simplify everything to naked man with knife and sizzler. And yeah, I'm going to be outraged if it's as opposed to, you know, a guy on a hot summer day and he always has a knife and, oh, he went to Sizzler. Well, technically that's the same story, but it's phrased differently because how much time do I have to get the nuanced story of the guy going to Sizzler? I mean, it's why I stopped reading stuff on the internet.
I'll tell you this. You have a lot less time since the advent of the modern time zones in the late 1800s.
Well, funny you should say that. They said the telegraph is going to ruin everything because why do I want to know what's happening in London here in America?
When Benjamin Franklin introduced it in the late 1800s, I hope you know where I'm going with this. Okay, but the other thing, you're right. And so I've never even thought about that concept of time. And I do wonder, we've talked about before, James Kerwin, our friend, made a movie about this, but the idea of time as being a construct of one part of the brain, I'd be fascinated as to how reading things electronically from backlit screens affects the time center of our brain, if at all. But I would be curious about that. Because one thing we do know from studies is that the empathic centers of the brain are not activated when we read from backlit screens. When you read a book on ebook versus a book on printed material, you are reading it with different parts of your brain.
Right.
And so we remember things differently, obviously. We remember different things also. But our empathy is not activated. And this is such a critical component to me of modern life and how we take in our news. Obviously, right? This would be true if your major source of news going back decades was even the evening news, right? The evening news is a mediated experience. Your empathy was not going to be as activated as it would be through reading a newspaper. But when the evening news was the main source of information for so many people, it wasn't like there was 24-hour news available. You were getting it in short bursts. Now,
right,
there's no escaping it if you are tied in to your devices. You're getting alerts all the time. You're checking Twitter all the time. You're getting at least in 140 characters and less these news bursts, and you're not taking them in with any empathic part of your brain. And to go one step further, this also, people might say, well, I stay away from the news sites for that reason. I stay away from Twitter for that reason. Oh, but are you on Facebook? Do you read your friends' posts?
Right.
Well, yeah. Well, that's how you're taking in news.
Yeah.
And
it's always news. There's always news.
And it's not news. It's also not news. And I would argue it's not news because this came up when I talked about that Breakfast Club that I walked back from. One of the reasons I walked back from it was I've gotten into this kind of routine over the last couple weeks since finding out that Lily's predecessor as president of the Breakfast Club has died. I have gone through this little routine of walking the routes that I knew he walked because he lived up on Los Feliz Boulevard. And he was a fixture in the neighborhood for years before I ever joined the Breakfast Club. I would see him. And in retirement, he was steadfast in getting his steps in every day. And so I enjoy kind of walking in the footsteps of this man that, Lily quite literally is walking, or figuratively is walking in as a president of the Breakfast Club. And so anyway, that's not a big deal. But I was so pleased that in our Breakfast Club groups, there hadn't been posts about his death. We were all waiting to either talk about the news when we were together or to share the news with those who hadn't heard when we were together. And there were, and so we were really disappointed when it just got posted as a share to the private group page, while acknowledging that this is how some people share news or get their news. And yet, it's not news if you do it that way. It's gossip, period.
Right.
It's gossip. And there was a response actually posted about how, and I get this, and this really is sad, but some people feel that they are well served by taking in things on their own this way. This is how I want to hear about something. I want to be on my own so that I can deal with my feelings my own way. I can respond in my own fashion. But as we've just talked about, your empathic center is not activated.
Right.
So you're not able to respond. You're able to react. And, you know, healthcare practitioners, mental health practitioners will point out that grief is a collective process. It's a group process. It's not something that can be done alone.
Right.
So you can't start to grieve until you start that process with other people.
Interesting.
But I also am just worried about people taking in so much bad news that you can get so fast. There used to be a time when if there was bad news, Dean, could you come in? Could you have a seat? How are you? Do you need anything? You know, just cut to the chase. Get to the bad news, right?
Now, what's the bad news?
Now we get the bad news in a tweet or a text or a Facebook post. And we feel safer or stronger as a result. And yet, ironically, we're much weaker and more weakened as a result. The only thing we're protected from is feelings of vulnerability.
Right.
Of, oh dear, this person's going to see my feelings. I'm not going to be in control of my feelings in front of other people. I'm going to be vulnerable. As our caterer, our wonderful woman, Gail, who catered the wedding, of course, she said, oh, yeah, we mustn't be vulnerable. Mustn't be vulnerable. And I said, why, Gail? And she said, oh, because something might happen. And that's really it. It's the fear over that something that might happen. And, but you know, we were talking about this going back to how many people, you know, of a certain ilk, it seemed, died, because we do our celebrity deaths so often. And we were talking about how many people of a certain ilk died in the week immediately following the 2016 presidential election.
Right.
And we weren't blaming this on the outcome or the result, but we talked about how for so many people, the result of that election was to feel the wind taken out of their sails.
Yeah, right.
And if you're facing any kind of, especially health problem, or you're someone of a certain age, I've noticed with the Breakfast Club, you can't afford to let the wind be taken out of your sails.
Right.
You because you are truly then vulnerable to certain challenges, physical challenges that might be facing you. Hell, in this country, look at the gun epidemic and the mass shootings and the suicide epidemics. What happens to these people when the wind gets out of their sails? Often they plunge into mental illness.
Right. Yeah. It starts with mild depression and goes from there. Basically.
And so with bad news, yes, you might feel vulnerable being around other people, but this is the nature of having friends and family and loved ones that they let you know, hey, I know that you feel that the you know, for lack of a better word, that the winds are out of your sails right now because of this. But we're here to let you know X, Y, and Z and to put life back into you. to breathe wind back into your sails. Maybe
re-inspire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So many of us are denying ourselves that in the name of not wanting to feel vulnerable, and yet the irony is we're making ourselves truly vulnerable by isolating ourselves and taking in news that way instead of letting it be shared and sharing it in a more human, and I like to think humane, way. There needs to be the human component of the interaction when we are sharing this news. It is better to have that interaction, and it's better to have the empathic centers activated.
Right. Huh. Well, didn't I learn something today?
Well,
I'm not reading books on my iPad anymore.
Well, you're also going to teach us a little something, because I went to an improv show the other night, and afterwards, you know, I was offering up some notes, and and it's interesting because people say they want to know how they did. But they don't mean it. They want you to tell them that they did great. But, and then when it comes to an improv show offering notes, it's so interesting, though I've never experienced this to be true with the most veteran improv performers such as yourself. But there is this knee jerk of people who are maybe less confident in what they're doing to say, wait, are you really rewriting an improv routine? And I want to say, you're damn right I am. Because here were all the possibilities available, and you weren't aware of any of them because you'd written yourself into a corner before you ever got on stage.
Exactly. And the whole nature of it
is to open yourself. And I found myself thinking about two things that I'd love for you to share. One is how, going back all the way to when we made that first trip to London for Sci-Fi London, back in, I think, 2004, and you did some improv back there at Sci-Fi London, and I was allowed behind the curtain and was revealed that, like, an hour before the show, you were there backstage doing yoga.
Yes.
And
stretching.
And I find it so, I obviously understand the pre-show regimen can be so important, but I was really struck now in retrospect by you doing it there. You didn't do it at the hotel and then come and perform. You did it there. You found a space there. You immersed yourself as much as possible in the atmosphere, or surrounded yourself in the atmosphere of where you were going on. And then plunged into this mind-body-focused exercise that you would... So can you speak to that a little bit, the importance of that?
Well, yeah. Well, for me, because I'm oriented to space, to the physical, the space, the stage, you know, like when I performed in the West End, it was exciting being in that space and thinking you're in this dressing room where Sir Laurence Olivier put on makeup one time, or, you know, whatever that, and you could hear the subway above the dressing room and how much history you were sitting in there, that if you don't have a moment of mind, body, physicality in that space, you kind of will be, in my head anyway, I'll be thinking about the space separate from my show. So I'll be like, oh, hey, I'm doing a show. And hey, look at this theater. It's really nice. Whereas it should be, hey, it's a cumulative effect. People have come to this theater to see my show. Not that I'm looking at the theater along with the audience and going, hey, I got great seats. I'm almost in the show itself. Oh, right. So it's a way of not disassociating. So that way I can be present on stage and be present in my improv.
Yeah.
So that's A.
So that distraction, I mean, to a degree, you're kind of jokingly simplifying it. But I think there's practical, you know, so many practical real world applications in what you described, right? How did the job interview go? Oh, it was terrible. I was so distracted by that horrible smell, you know, or the fluorescent lights or whatever. You know, we are affected by our surroundings. And yet, again, we spend most of modern life trying to pretend we're not affected by our surroundings by making every place we go just like every other place we go, or by bringing our devices with us so we can escape into them. And yet we are beings of energy. We are affected by energy. Each place we go has a unique energy, whatever comes into play with that. How we feel in different places is different. And if only we were more attuned to how we feel, we would know that. One of the exercises I do with my acting students is, when you go home, I want you to feel how you feel differently behind the wheel of the car than you do once you get out of the car. I want you to notice how you feel different outside your house before being inside the house. And then how about the fact that you feel different from room to room in your place? Each place inspires a different energetic relationship with your surroundings. So, and in the case of performers, obviously, the space you want to open yourself to fully is one that has never existed before, because it's one that is being built up truly by the locale, by the audience, by you, by the suggestions you're given. It truly has never existed before, but many components are going into it, and you want to avail yourself of all of them, or know which ones you need to make sure that you are aware has a very strong pull, for example, i.e. a distraction.
I made my students do the almost 2,000-year-old comedy sketch, which is a high status and a low status a train. Like, it's four actors or however many actors you want. But the high status guy is breaking into a house and he needs a tool for every obstacle. And he asks the second low status guy, and that he has to get the low status guy all the way at the end, has to get the bag of tools, hand it back up the chain of command. And they continue to mime a house breaking in, coming up with obstacles. So the guy in the high status has to be always thinking of what's next. And the low status guy has to be coming up with ridiculous props. And so it's object work, it's space work, and it's a sketch that apparently was done in the Dionysus festivals of Greece 23 centuries ago. So, you know, in itself, in your relationship to space is something that has gone on as a tradition, a comedy tradition, no less, that is and probably older than 23 centuries.
Well, and why do I bring it up? I bring it up to me because it's interesting, obviously, but also in this vein of, as I've said before and as I say in my acting classes, I loved Coach John Wooden of the UCLA basketball team when I was a kid, right? Mm-hmm. Not just because they won more championships than anybody else, but because of the distinction that he never, except once, ever coached his team about the other team at all. Only once in all those years did he ever make an exception where they planned for one player. But it was always about, no, we practice what we do. We develop our teamwork the best. And he did not consider himself a sports coach. He considered himself a teacher. And what was he teaching? He was trying to teach the building blocks of success in life. And he figured if he could teach the building blocks of success in life to his players, they would achieve success on the court. Because sports are valuable insofar as they are metaphors for real life. That's what he thought. And lo and behold, he's the most successful coach ever. Imagine that. So I really liked that. And it spoke to something that I felt dissatisfied about. I've spent no small amount of time in schools and taking classes through my life in my continued education and ongoing education. And I've found more and more specialized courses, especially when we get into the arts being a little bit disconnected from real life. And it really did speak to me, this idea that, you know, anything we're learning ought to have applications outside just the process that we're trying to master.
Right.
And the 10,000 hour rule shouldn't just apply to musicians and artists. It applies to computer programmers, for example.
Exactly.
And so in my acting class, I've always demanded that my students call me on stuff if I am giving them suggestions or trying to give them tools that are acting specific, that don't have real world applications. And I love this conversation about preparing ourselves for the space, opening ourselves for the space that comes through you with improv, and that I have witnessed with, like, Dan Butler when he's been on Broadway, he does the same. And that's a scripted performance. But you still want to be open and fully present to this space where you've never been before, because each performance is different than the one before. And you know, I was thinking a lot about how we've talked about the stand-up comedy boom, and then there really seemed to be a big sketch comedy boom, right? Like in the 80s, it was stand-up, and in the 90s, it was sketch comedy. And then in the recent era, it's become improv. And this, to me, is a very healthy evolution, and in some parts born out of the need of our isolation, of our lack of empathy, that nature has presented this as one of the possible ways out of it. Because it seems to me that the tools that are required for successful improv are absolutely tools that are required for surviving and thriving in modern life. You demonstrate this in The Truth Is Out There, but again, I'm just struck by it by watching a comedic group shut themselves down to all the possibilities available to them.
Right.
In the name of needing to be funny. And I came away going, you know, there's not enough stress being made towards performers, I think, in a lot of these circles, towards being interesting rather than funny.
Right.
Be interesting.
I always put it in genuine. Go to your real life when it comes up. Don't do wacka wacka, but do what you would do if no one was watching. And that is genuine, and that is interesting, and that is probably, because so unexpected, and coming from somewhere deep in your head, really funny. That's funnier than anything you could have thought was, hey, it's funny if I trip on a banana peel or something. No, you know, this is always the complaint I have, the Second City kind of thing. It's like, hey, my dog has no nose. Really? How's it smell? Awful. As opposed to, my dog has no nose. Oh, really? How's it smell? Well, I built this contraption, and then you do this, and you know, and you actually improvise how a dog would smell if it had no nose.
Yeah,
versus the punchline,
or authenticity, or like, oh my god, I feel so bad for you, or
yeah, right.
I don't like dogs. I don't really like dogs. You know,
right?
Like I'm more of a cat person, right? You've now identified your character that you're playing. If somebody's response is, I don't like dogs, I like cats, right? You've now, boy, that's a true person. That's a real person presenting themselves instead of, oh, I'm going to support the jokes. And but this idea of being interesting, I want to go to this place with you because I will tell you, as rare, at least, as really pleasing improv work, interesting improv work, are interesting conversationalists. I would say that they're just about as rare in the world. And yet, here's the thing about interesting improv I've learned from watching you. And here's the thing about interesting conversations from being a part of several through the years.
Right.
Only one participant needs to be really good at it in order for it to work. You bring up on stage people who've never done it before. You bring up people who are sometimes crushed by fear, and it's all right. it's all right. You know what you're doing. You're open to everything and you lead them through it. Isn't that true with a good conversation? Sometimes we measure the conversation by how good the other person is in the art of conversation. But truthfully, someone who is gifted at the art of conversation can author a wonderful conversation with someone who previously was not gifted at the art of conversation. And it comes down, in that case, to being interesting. And the best way to be interesting is to be interested.
Ah, exactly. Curiosity is where you want to be. Particularly, as you said, for all your acting students, be curious. See what it's like to be in your space. Feel. Go out when you're out and about. Be curious of things, quote unquote.
And that curiosity in improv, sure, that can lead to epic fail, we could say. But I don't consider it a failure because it will be interesting.
Yes.
You know, there are many shows where I'll go and I'll laugh. But I wouldn't say that I was particularly interested in it. And then there are some shows that can go so sideways that, wow, it's not funny. Wow, it's a train wreck. But it really is interesting. And especially so because if these people are really open, the performers, they know it. They know that this is going downhill bad. But they're still curious enough to follow it. And you know, it, to a degree, it's like I say with movies, right? It takes truly talented people to actually do bad work because only talented people will take chances and try things.
Take risk. Yeah. Well, and this is exactly what Keith Johnston said. He said, you're doing improv and you're not failing 1 out of 10 times. You're not improvising. You are not.
Oh,
you are just tagging the bases. Yeah. You're not swinging for the fences. You're just running. You're just taking a ball for a walk around the bases and waving at the crowd. So, you know, if you really are trying to swing and hit a home run, you are going to strike out 1 out of 10. At least. So if you see, you know, oh, these guys are so funny, they're always funny, then you're going, well, are they really improvising or do they just have a library of bits in their head that they're doing, you know?
Well, I kind of like that baseball analogy there, the idea of, you know, swinging for the fences, because any, you know, successful home run hitter, you know, is going to fail more often than not, obviously, first of all. But secondly, they're not just going up there hacking. They are looking for their pitch.
Right.
They are studying what's going on. They are waiting
open.
For a certain pitch in a certain circumstance. They are open and they're not
to
in a rush.
Experience.
They're not in a rush. Not in a rush, not in a hurry. And they're gonna wait for something that they can do something with.
Right.
And I have two different directions that I want to go in with this, but I'm going to choose one because I do want to get into movies. I think it's interesting that this movie that's getting pretty good reviews at Toronto International Film Festival, where it had its premiere, and is very anticipated by comic book fans, and is being talked up for maybe a Best Actor Oscar for Joaquin Phoenix. The Joker. The origin story of the Joker. It's set in 1981.
Uh-huh.
And it's set in the universe, we could say, of King of Comedy. And so it's going back to this era where stand-up comedy was about to explode. And it, again, like King of Comedy, is kind of exploring the ways that that can be a road to mental illness.
Right. Keep going.
Well, just you know, because the I mean, in these films, right, with Rupert Pupkin and with this character, that the mental processes are not one of opening and connecting and curiosity. It becomes a closed system as we could say.
Self-obsession, yes.
Yeah.
Obsession that, yeah, dwindles you down.
So I'm intrigued about this, and I'm intrigued about what it says about the evolution of comedy as a result. I'm also interested, as you know, about that because of a project that we're working on that we're not really at liberty to discuss, but it is about comedy in its own way as well. So I'm fascinated to watch that. It's intriguing to me that, you know, De Niro is in it, speaking of King of Comedy, and he's playing very much the Jerry Langford role. He's playing the television host now.
Right.
And he acknowledges that, yes, it is an intentional nod of the cap to the idea that this is set in the King of Comedy universe. And in fact, he was willing and game to play Rupert Pupkin as the host if they wanted to set this later and show that, yeah, the evolution was that this guy ends up taking over that show. And I think there was talk about doing that, but the rights got thorny on that.
Damn it.
So they couldn't overtly exist, you know, in that universe. But clearly they do in terms of, you know, the their lineage, they exist.
Anyway. Yeah. Oh, that's fun.
So it's interesting. I'm intrigued for that film then for several reasons that I'm rarely intrigued by a comic book movie. Here I am. And I'm intrigued for reasons that obviously have very little to do with most comic book movies. And but I would caution, right, this is not going to be a great movie. This is still going to be a movie directed by the guy most famous for the Hangover movies. And indeed, that's the point. The difference between a King of Comedy by Martin Scorsese and a Joker movie by Todd Phillips, as inventive and interesting and subtextual as the movie might be, this is a director whose instincts are always to make the obvious choice, and he does. I mean, that sounds more harsh than it is, but that can be very satisfying, right?
Absolutely.
That can be very satisfying. It doesn't risk epic fail, nor is it as interesting as making the kind of choices that Scorsese made in King of Comedy that led to one of the biggest box office disasters of all time, and also led to a movie that a comic book franchise would try to emulate decades later.
Right.
So you know, people should maintain their expectations a little bit is what I'm saying. About
this. Oh, so that Oscar, I shouldn't be on the Oscar betting pool already
for Joaquin Phoenix, perhaps.
Yeah. Okay.
But I would say this about the last time a comic book movie won a major Oscar for an acting category. I think there hasn't been one since then, right? Heath Ledger, when he wins for The Joker. And that was a unique set of circumstances, also about it being posthumous. But if we can say that he would have won regardless, even if he had not died, and I think you kind of made the point that the performance might have ended up being better had he not died, because they made certain choices editorially that felt like they made it because the actor died. You know, that we're going to use every little bit of footage that we have, for example, and
some of it should have been on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. So anyway, it may have even been a better performance, but the thing about that movie is, it was a huge success, and Christopher Nolan is the kind of director who will sometimes surprise you by the choices that he makes. So that is possible. But I find it fascinating after more than a decade of dominance, not only in the comic book world, but at the box office, by the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that we're getting this interesting-seeming Joker movie from DC the same year that we get a really quite pleasing and funny sort of family story out of the DC universe in their Shazam movie.
Yeah. And no, I haven't seen that.
Oh, I'm kind of disappointed that you haven't. I want to have a conversation with you about Captain Marvel versus Captain Marvel.
Yeah, right.
Because, of course, Shazam was known to me as a kid as Captain Marvel. But I'd be interested in it. You know, it's available on disc. Both of those are available, you know, on demand and on disc and home video, yeah. all the different purveyors. They both work best as comedies. And Shazam is far more committed to that as a character comedy. So I'd be interested in it. But I do, after really, really going hard against the DC cinematic universe for many years, it utterly lost its way after Chris Nolan left, the unremitting harshness of its tone. And now here we are, and there is no consistency in tone at all from movie to movie in the DC universe, as opposed to the Marvel universe, where they are remarkably consistent tonally from movie to movie,
right.
In large part so that they can all fit together, because that's where they yeah. were all heading. And that tone can be very pleasing. But again, they're not leaving a lot of room for error. And
yes, there's a giant hierarchy of meetings that happen to make all of those Marvel things interconnect and function the way they do. That's a real conscious effort that I don't think DC even wanted to do, frankly.
Yeah, I think. Are you saying that they didn't want to put an interconnected kind of universe together?
Yeah.
Well, no, I think they did. Remember, they did the Justice League movie, and they were introducing all these characters. I think they did want to do just that, and then they scrapped it. You know, they've scrapped a lot of these movies as being interconnected pieces, and hence we're getting kind of these one-offs like the Joker, or we're going in different directions with Shazam. But it's cool. It's cool that under this umbrella, you can have all these different approaches. And yeah, they might fail.
Right.
But they also might prove interesting in ways that we need.
Yes, exactly. In the ways that we need. What is the movies that we need right now? That's a great question.
And I think some people needed that Shazam movie. They needed,
a light.
Not only light, but also a movie that talked about kids' needs for heroes and what does that mean? I think it was a kind of a noble little movie, actually. And then, you know, this movie, The Joker, that, as I said, clearly seems to have, especially apropos of our conversation about, you know, what improv can teach us about leading healthy lives full of empathy and interaction and interest and curiosity, right? I think that The Joker is a movie that can participate in that needed conversation or maybe start its own. So let's leave it there. There's other elements of this that I want to talk about. I want to talk about De Niro. I want to talk about another movie he has coming up, The Irishman. I mean, when was the last time I found upcoming Robert De Niro movies interesting, for crying out loud?
I know, really?
But there's a tie-in with his Scorsese movie, The Irishman, to this conversation about comic book movies, because the technology of de-aging actors really seemed to get its fullest expression thus far and its best expression thus far in superhero movies. The Sam Jackson de-aging work in Captain Marvel, I had to kind of remind myself recently, oh yeah, they did that to him. In fact, he was younger in that movie than he ever was when he appeared in a movie before. Because he was into middle age when he became a star.
Yeah, right.
And,
well, that's true, right? With Jeff Bridges in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, that opening sequence, I thought, how did they get this 60s footage? And from what movie?
Oh, fascinating. But, fascinating. Yeah. Whereas, like, when they did it with Muglis in the Ant-Man, you could tell they're, okay, they're doing some you know, CGI trickery here. Who knows? I mean, yeah. It begs the question, if Tarantino's Trek gets made, does Shatner play Kirk?
Yeah.
I'm not joking. I mean, that might really be a possibility. It's very expensive technology, but Scorsese uses it for half of his forthcoming Netflix movie, The Irishman, to de-age De Niro and Pacino. And it is what's cool about the Irishman trailer, if you haven't seen it, watch it, and we'll put this on the agenda for next week, Dean. The Irishman trailer to me plays like simply Scorsese talking to a whole generation of filmmakers saying, all right, comic book filmmakers, you think you know how to use CGI and effects? Here's my slow reveal of how it's actually done.
Wow.
And you'll see what I mean, because it keeps coming back to a certain shot of De Niro on the phone revealing more and more. And so we'll talk about this. So many issues I want to talk about in terms of this de-aging, in terms of some upcoming movies. Also, I want to talk about a handful of current releases. So let's talk about all that next week. I would be remiss if I did not mention two things. One, you have your live improv streaming show, Gravity Hole.
Yes.
Is there going to be an episode this week?
Yes, we had to. We're switching our metrics, our ability to hit the platforms with announcements, and so we're going to give it a shot on this Wednesday. Will be our next live Gravity Hole happening.
Where?
9 p.m. Eastern time.
Where though? Wednesday 9 p.m. Eastern. Where do people go to see it?
You can go to the Gravity Hole Facebook page or the Dean Haglund Facebook page. I think we'll try to do concurrently. Twitter, or just go to gravityhole.com, and we'll have that also streaming live there. Now, and we have a YouTube channel, I think.
Okay, because I've tried to find the old episodes at the Gravity Hole page. We once linked to them, and I couldn't find them.
What? Oh, brother.
So
okay,
the website is gravityhole.com, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, gravityhole.com.
Okay, well, we will try to link to these things as best as possible, but Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern, streaming live. Yeah, I don't know. okay, it looks like now, yes, there is a link that's working. Episodes are working. The most recent, a 3-minute teaser is on the splash page. So we will try to link to these as best as possible. And
thank you.
Hopefully that now, no, the episodes link doesn't.
No, you got to go. Don't hit when you're on the episodes thing, go to the top and then they sort of shuffle through. Do you see?
Yeah, or they don't.
Look at that.
Or they don't, as it turns out. But anyway, this is a fascinating podcasting right now. The other thing that I guess I would be, we haven't in a little while done our segment of Futures Past where we reveal what we were talking about 12 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And there was no reason to do it this week, because 12 years ago, we didn't do a show. We've always maintained that we had never missed a week. But between episodes 19 and 20 was a fortnight. We did take a week off that first year.
What the hell? How? I can't even imagine.
We've made up for it 12 years later by going almost 70 minutes or 65 minutes if you don't count us looking at the Gravity Hole webpage. Okay, that's it. Find lots of our episodes, chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com, where you can download them and stream them. You can even subscribe via iTunes.
Yay! And even like us.
Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Every episode we've ever done is available on Blog Talk Radio, so search for the show on Blog Talk Radio. Finally, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. How do they do that, Dean?
We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
And write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, as our dear friend Maurice Terenzio is doing right now.
Please.
Send us an email, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.